This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We've got to stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings.
The time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well, now you've got it.
Right! You tell them I'm coming! And hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
Welcome to Crypt Ricks I've Been Thinking. What's this show all about? Well, it's all in the title. He enjoys interviewing people about issues that he finds interesting and which cause him to sit back and think. Cryptocurrency, true crime, natural law, the occult. No topic is off limits here. He has always enjoyed when people give their points of view or thoughts on different topics that they have researched. And what makes it all great is that it's their unique take on what is being discussed. For that reason alone, it makes it interesting to him. So take that walk down to his crypt. Make yourself comfortable. And just maybe, he will be discussing a topic that you have been thinking about. Here's your host, Crypt Rick.
Well, welcome, everybody. We are here. It is another Monday evening. Hope everybody had themselves a great weekend. I know on my end, I'm trying to stay warm, and I am so ready for spring. I mean, this is about the time of the year where the cold just starts to get to me, and it's been really cold and damp here, and I'm ready for spring. I can honestly say that. It's getting to that point now, and it happens every time around this time of the year, every winter. I just get to it's like my breaking point. So spring, I hope you are on your way, because I am done with the cold for another season. Bring on the nice summer. That's what I'm in spring, I'll take anything that's warm at this point. But so hopefully everybody had a great weekend. I'm glad you're all joining, and you know, hopefully we're going to have a great show this evening. I just want to let everyone know before I get my guest on that, as I always say, this is all listener supported here at Revolution Radio. So, I mean, you guys that listen, that you know, all your donations go to keeping this station up and running and freedom alive. And to me, that is very, very important, especially now more than ever, is freedom. I mean, that is the thing that so many people are standing up for now, the truckers and lots of protesters. They are fighting for our freedom. And I support them for that. And I mean, what a great way to support this station, you know, where freedom is alive. People can talk about what they want. There's a lot of great hosts discussing a lot of great topics. So if you can donate, there's a lot of great ways you can. We have Patreon where you can, you know, select a price range that works for you. A great way to support. We also have direct payment. We also take cryptocurrency, which is amazing because I know a lot of people are getting into cryptocurrency and starting to look into that area. I know I am. So we know we accept Bitcoin, Ethereum, Bitcoin Cash. So definitely check that out. And then don't forget, you can also check out the shop. Look for some great stuff. Got great t-shirts, coffee mugs, a lot of great stuff. And all of that goes to keeping this channel, you know, station up and running. And as I said, freedom alive. So donate if you can, guys. It is super, super appreciated. And it's a great cause. So every little bit helps. But enough of that for now. I just want to go ahead and take the time to welcome my guest, Mr. Dan Henning. Are you there, sir?
Yes. Yes, I am here. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for taking the time to come and chat with me. I'm just going to let people know Mr. Dan Henning started, came across him was in with the David Crowley case and him doing a lot of research. He did start the Facebook page, the Justice for David Crowley and Family Facebook page. So definitely check that out, guys. It's getting bigger and bigger. They're almost up to 4,000 people subscribe to that Facebook page, and there's always dialogue going on in there, and new members coming all the time. And you know, it's a great place to go if you want to start looking into the David Crowley case. I've had Greg Fernandez Jr. on here, who looks into the case, and I've also had William Rail on, who we kind of touched on the David Crowley case too. And it's a topic that I've been looking into for a few years now, and it's one of those cases. I love, you know, true crime and looking into stuff like that. So, Dan, like, let everyone know a little bit about yourself and what got you started into looking into the David Crowley case.
Well, thank you. I live in Minnesota, and the David Crowley, the triple homicide that took place there was in a town called Apple Valley, Minnesota. It's roughly 40,000 in population, so it's not a small town. It's also not a big city, but I had formerly lived there about less than a half a mile where this murder, triple homicide took place. And so this was earlier on when I was raising kids and whatnot. Now I'm about 30 minutes away from the location. But when the murder first took place, it caught my eye, you know, number one, because it was close. And number two, it had all the fingerprints of a deep state hit or an assassination. And having two young daughters myself, the fact that there was a 5-year-old girl involved also piqued my interest in the fact of I was a dad at that age and had young daughters, and it really hit home to me by seeing this family murdered and nothing really being done about it. So those three things really drew me into it, Rick, and as far as how I got it going into this case, because it didn't really sit well, you know, right away. It was the beginning of 2015, January 2015. And I was working. I work as an accountant, and you know, the story came up on the local news, and it seems strange how it was presented, how it was delivered. And they kind of just mentioned that he was this gun activist guy. He was a conspiracy theorist, a very bright young guy, 28 years old, recently married, mm-hmm. with a 5-year-old girl. And so they said he just obviously must have killed his daughter, his wife, and then himself. And so, right. You know, first of all, that didn't sit right, because I could never imagine a situation where that would ever take place in reality, you know, basically. So mm-hmm. I thought, well, that's odd. I would never envision doing that ever, no matter how bad things ever got. Typically with suicide cases, they're dealing with people who have been suicidal for a while. They've thought about it. They've planned it for a while. And they typically, for the most part, don't involve other people. Unless there's a jealousy thing, they may want to kill the girlfriend or the ex-wife or the current wife or something, and then themselves. But very rarely the entire family gets involved. So it was very strange. And so I did a couple searches on Google, went to some of their browsers, saw what was coming up at the time, and there was just a handful of stories all with the same, basically the same narrative. And I'm like, well, this doesn't seem – it didn't really seem right. I have set up and run about 12 to 15, I think, different Facebook groups that I've created over the years that are on the justice, kind of true crime, mystery solving pages on Facebook. Okay. And most of them will draw on a, on an actual case. The members range between 30 members to maybe 350 members. Local people get involved, and it's kind of a one-stop shop to talk about the case in an open forum without being censored. And so I set up a page called Justice for David Crowley and Family, because I did not believe he killed himself. I thought that it was a hit. It was a murder. It was assassination. And the fact that it was quickly solved in a matter of 2 days, and they were already going under the assumption that it was a double murder.
Right, right. You're right, too, because I remember seeing a news report, and within 24 hours, they were already putting that narrative out that it was a murder-suicide. And I found that incredible. Like, within 24 hours, before they'd done any real testing, they couldn't have had time to do testing. They couldn't have done really anything, but a very quick walkthrough, in my opinion, even in that 24-hour period. You got to remember, there's a lot of different people that have to go through that crime scene from the time that they discover it. And to come on the news, and I heard it myself, and I've heard it, seen it printed in print too, where they were already spinning that narrative, in my opinion, right from the start. Within the first 24 hours, it was, you know, this looks like a murder-suicide. David, you know, he snapped and he killed his wife and his daughter and then himself. They were already spinning that. So you must have found that strange, like you were saying, like I did.
Yeah, the wording was interesting because, like you said, Rick, it wasn't that they were contemplating that. It's not like they were entertaining that solution as a possible, you know, something that happened. They were basically saying that it did happen,
right,
that way. And I, like you, thought, well, there's a lot of tests and things that need to be done, and a lot of examinations. That this could take, you know, several months. It could take a year before we find out what happened. And I think it was 24 hours they were talking about it. Like that, and it was 48 hours later, I think the first article came out saying it's a double murder suicide. And yeah, we're going to finalize everything up and tie a little nice little bow on it and call it good. And so I created the page because I thought it was a hit, a murder, something like that, because I can't imagine him doing this. And then close family, friends, and coworkers all came out and said that this never would have been the case. This is a guy that was upbeat, highly intelligent, very excited for the future, was happily married to his loving wife and had a daughter that he adored. And they said that there's no way that this would have
happened.
You know, so that kind of drew me in, and I created this page and started getting some grasp from memberships of people looking into this case. Mainly the members that were interested in this case all came from around the country and other countries. Very, very few were from the Twin Cities, Minneapolis-St. Paul area, which is – this is Eagan. It's just a suburb outside of Minneapolis and St. Paul, maybe 15 minutes south of there. And so not many from the local group, local people, were involved or interested in this case. But it got a lot of support from California, New York, and London, and the UK, and other countries really were interested in this because I think one of the big stories was in the UK. The Daily Mail had one of the first news stories that actually broke the story for this case. And so it wasn't even really anything local. So it was very interesting. It just didn't sit right. And I had covered a handful of other crimes like this where it was a assassination or a hit or a government hit. And I follow a lot of other true crimes that, you know, folks call them conspiracies, but they actually turned into be true crime. They actually turned into be true conspiracies. And so those are the kind of things I follow. The most important thing in a situation like that is to catch it quick, and to look at the disconnects in the story, to get on it right away. A lot of times in a case like this, they're not really starting to be looked at with different set of eyes for a couple, 2-3 years later. And then you start digging in and finding out all these anomalies. Here, because I jumped on it right away the day that the news article hit and created the page, it was right off the bat. So any link that I found, I put it on to this Facebook group for anyone to read. You can make up your own conclusions, come up to your own what you think happened. But I just pulled everything that I could off the internet, anything that I could glean about this case or this story, and put it on a nice, easy-to-read format on a Facebook page that was open to the public.
Right. And I remember you were, when we did – because I have done an interview with Dan for my YouTube channel, That's where I do my video interviews. So I want to thank you, Dan, for doing that interview, because like that was an amazing interview too. And that's why I wanted to have you on here, because I do know a lot of people that are very drawn to this case for some reason. And as your Facebook page group shows, you know, like you've got that like almost 4,000 members. And every time I look, you're getting more and more members. So it's definitely a case that people are very curious about. And once you start looking into it, it really starts to take on a new feel for me when I started really digging into it. Now, I remember in our last interview when we were talking and you said you created this Facebook page, you started getting flack right away when you created this Facebook page. So a lot of people were not happy that you created this page, if I remember well. And so what, like, can you let people know kind of what happened in that area? Because I do know that, you know, that you were saying that they were not happy at first that you created this page and started diving into this case.
Well, it's very, very interesting how it all came to. One of the first cases that I recall ever as far as a conspiracy or a deep state crime taking place and also getting busted in real time was the Sandy Hook school shootings.
That was
the very first one that I was on an internet forum watching that all take place, and people were doubting it right away, saying the inconsistencies, there's no way this is real, none of this stuff could be, and then pointing out, much like what we're seeing now with the war conflict in the with the Ukraine and Russia,
right,
these differing stories and the video footage, the fit photos, things don't line up, and there's propaganda involved. And so Sandy Hook was very interesting to me by being able to be on that first round of the key players that saw where things didn't jive. None of these things, of course, made the mainstream news, and to this day we're still called conspiracy theorists. But a man by the name of Thomas Lapp was I remember the name there when the Sandy Hook was going on. This was back in 2012. So now it's 3 years later. I jump on, get a page going for this justice looking for David Crowley. And unbeknownst to me, this Thomas Lapp creates a community group on Facebook saying it's a group called Justice for David Crowley of Gray State. We both created our pages on the same day, January 19th, 2015, the same day.
Wow, interesting.
The first articles came out about this, both unbeknownst to each other. Now, David Crowley was in this group called the Gray State, on a team called the Gray State Project. And they were a group that was into looking into deep state crimes, involved with Alex Jones, doing a lot of work with InfoWars, going to a lot of activism, conventions and meetups and things like that. And Gray State was one of these groups that actually had a lot of ideas and things similar to mine, opening the door, pulling the curtain open on some of the deep state, who's really pulling the strings, what's really going on here in the world, in our nation, in our country, and how can this corruption be running rampant? Now, I didn't hear of Gray State. I never even heard of David Crowley's name before the crimes took place, but this Thomas Lapp did and was a big follower of the Gray State. Now, this Gray State project was set up doing a lot of podcasts, doing a lot of interviews, going on site. They were mainly made up of a bunch of guys that didn't have full-time jobs, but were doing this for a living, almost like your radio show here with Revolution Radio. There's a lot of podcasts out there that have been going on like this. They were very popular,
right,
so much so that they had a script written and were going to make a movie.
Yeah, definitely tell people about that, like a little bit about David Crowley, because I should have mentioned that, Dan, and I apologize for people that die. I'm assuming that a lot of people know this case, so I should go back and say, like, David, like, let people know who David Crowley was. He was how he's a soldier and what kind of happened to him and how he got disgruntled with what happened to him, having to go back for another service, like another term, I guess you would call it, another tour. So can you kind of let people know who David Crowley was and then how he got into doing the Gray State and what the Gray State is? Because some people might not even know. So I mean,
yes, that's a good point. David Crowley was a Minnesotan. I think he was the middle child of a family of three in Minnesota. Didn't really want to go to college and said, I'm going to go into the military, and went in and served a first round tour in boy, I think he was in the Persian, not the Persian Gulf, but he was in, not Afghanistan the first time, but maybe, I think it was Iraq, and finished his deal and came back home and then had met at the Army, at the base. He was based in Texas. Met a girl named his future wife. He met, she was living in Texas, Komel Alam. Komel.
Right.
And so he met her. They started dating. They quickly got engaged, and they were thinking of moving back to Minnesota and getting married, raising a family. By this time, he had gotten a call to be re-enlisted back, and there's a certain phrase for that when you get called back, even though you're
not. Yeah, I can't remember it either. I was hoping you would stop something.
Yeah, you've served your time. You've done your commitment, and then he got the call back, and he said, "No, I'm getting married. I've already done my time." They said, "No, you've got to come back." And he also went on to say that, you know what, I had a bad experience there on working there in the military, working overseas. I saw a lot of things that didn't sit well with me in my belief system. David came from a Christian family, knew right from wrong, and didn't like the corrupt things that he saw. And came back home to get married, and actually started doing some of this waking up, as we call it, or red pilling people. He started waking up to some of these things that didn't make sense in life. And they said, "Nope, you got to go back. But if you're going to cause any problems here in the military, we don't want you speaking out, criticizing it. So we're going to put you in the mailroom."
Right.
So he came, did his second tour in Afghanistan or Iraq, vice versa. One or the other was one, and then the other one was the second one, and didn't like it, but he put his head down, got his job done. He worked office work, was not out in the military, out in the fields. They put him in a mailroom spot. He got to be real good friends with one of his bosses and commanders, and made the best use of it. But at the same time, he started compiling a library of things that he did not like and things that he did not agree with. Well, at the same time, he was planning his wedding and wanting to raise a family and whatnot. Now, back at that time, the Bradley Manning thing was really big in 2009, 2010.
Right.
The whistleblower in the military that leaked out those things. So that became very interesting to David, and I think he kind of followed on those coattails and says, you know, I can agree with a lot of this stuff because it doesn't make sense. It's not just right or wrong, but it's criminal what's going on. It's
exactly
going on. It's criminal in nature, and the military folks, the vets that come back, aren't allowed to talk about it and whatnot. And all we hear about is this 22, suicides a day in the military veterans and how they can't deal with things. And he was another one, like how I believe it's more of the suicides in the military vets from the U.S. military come back home, and they've got so much to hide and there's so much they can't talk about that sometimes the easiest way out of dealing with the corruption, the lies, is to kill themselves because they can't really have a platform or a forum to get out there to be a whistleblower, to tell the public what's really going on. So I think he started writing all this stuff down and compiling everything. He got out of his second term, finished that, completed, won some medals of recommendation, really was a decorated military serviceman vet, came back home to Minnesota. Got an apartment, got a car, had a child. His daughter's name was Rani, they had lived in an apartment. And at this time, him and his group was getting together. You know, We Are Change was very popular back then.
Yes.
Some of these other activist groups were becoming very popular later to only be infiltrated. We Are Change and some of these other other groups that began in earnest. Rightly so, like much like how Black Lives Matter started off. It all was very innocent to start with until these groups
get infiltrated.
And run, and it causes all division and whatnot. So he found this group. They wanted to pitch a movie. He went back to school and got a degree in broadcast, not journalism, but it's TV, audio visual. What's the word? TV director. A movie person. He got that degree and really got the specifics down on how to film and how to be a cinematographer and how to do the audio, the video, and the scenes and really had a talent in it. His
I agree.
His teacher said that he's a really gifted guy as far as being able to take this, and he was very intelligent as far as IQ as well. Very, very bright. Maybe not book smart, but he knew he had an ambition, very ambitious in life. And so he got these group of guys together. They called themselves the Gray State Project, and they started exposing evil, basically being good guys, exposing evil on these interviews and whatnot. Got a script together. They put together a trailer, Rick. They put together a movie trailer first. This is where the confusion begins. A lot of people covering the story, they see this two-minute trailer. Rick, the first time you saw that two-minute movie trailer, you thought it was something coming out of a new Hollywood blockbuster movie deal.
For sure.
So
yes.
Good.
That's what I have to let people know. And if you haven't seen the trailer, definitely you can find it on YouTube. It's all over YouTube, the Gray State trailer. And it's incredible. I remember when I first saw that, it was just like, wow, like this guy who's ever doing this and like is really hitting the mark and was going after all the stuff that people are trying to expose. And really, you know, it was chilling when I saw it. I was just like, wow. And then that's, I totally agree with what you say. Like you could tell that he had a gift for his visual was right on par. Like it was right on par with this trailer. So I'm definitely glad that you brought that up. It's a trailer that people should definitely check out to get a feel for where David was coming from.
Yeah, it was super, super interesting. Most people, if not all, saw the trailer and says, when is this movie coming out? I've got to get to the theater to see this. That was the only thing on their mind, and they can't wait to see it. So based on that trailer and wanting to see it and the potential for this to be on the big screen in theaters is what folks were thinking that this was. We had all, I'd say 90% of the people who saw it, had already assumed the movie was done, filmed, in the can, ready to go, and we were just waiting for a release date.
Right.
And David Crowley went back and says, no, I created the trailer first. I put $61,000 into creating a Hollywood top flight version of a trailer using a GoFundMe, I think a campaign to raise money.
All crowdsourced.
Like, yeah, yes.
All crowdsourced.
And by this time, they put the movie out on YouTube, the trailer, while at the same time was pitching the script and using this trailer to go to Hollywood producers and such to see who would pick it up and what would be able to carry it, produce it, and make the film. And so he used it more of as a sales pitch to get the, here's what I want to do. The script's already done. If there's anyone interested in getting a big Hollywood production deal going to do this, that would be awesome. Now, at the same time, his movie was also exposing some of the Hollywood elites and some of the corruption in Hollywood. So he also knew that they wouldn't probably get picked up to have another, a big blockbuster in the theaters.
Exactly.
Maybe a smaller film production company would pick it up. So the fact of the matter is he made the trailer first. That viewing on YouTube gained over 2 million views in a couple of years, Rick.
Right. Yeah,
they had
right
2
up.
Million views. People all over the world were watching this view and the trailer and knowing the name Gray State and knowing the name David Crowley. He had begun to get like a cult following.
Yeah.
Very, you know, a young, in-shape guy, a good-looking guy, and females who watched it and followed him but fell in love with his charismatic charm. And guys thought he was a great guy to hang out with and to do stuff with. And, guys liked him and the chicks liked him. Everyone liked David Crowley. He turned into almost like this cult hero. And so he was on top of the world, you can say. And so right after all this happened, they bought a house, moved in 2013. That trailer, I think they put together for that movie, Rick, was 2012. And then him and his wife bought a house in Apple Valley, Minnesota, a little one-level, one-story Rambler in Apple Valley, and they moved in December 2013, and they were getting their lives situated. Their daughter was entering preschool. His wife was a nutritionist, healthy eating. He was working out a lot. Both were very in shape and all about healthy eating, healthy lifestyle. So that's what they were into. He was pitching the movie, and A year later, all three bodies were found dead with gunshot wounds to the head, and they said he must have went off and you know killed them all. So this really got the momentum started really jumping on, like you mentioned, the Facebook pages. Those following the Gray State Project and big fans of David Crowley jumped onto the Thomas Lapp created page right away, because right. his page was looking for justice for the Gray State Project and for David Crowley, whereas mine, I didn't know about the project. I just felt bad and felt sympathetic for David Crowley and his family, meaning his daughter and his wife. So I created that page, and I got a lot of the empathy crowd of those, like, well, how could this have happened? And whereas his got a lot of the fans. And then we found out that we each had the same page, and the Gray State guys, the rest of the guys in his group, the rest of the, boy, the group, I'll call it the Gray State Project. It was almost like a small company that was
right.
like an almost like a smaller version of an InfoWars or something. And those were the guys that contacted Thomas Lapp right away when they found out that he had a page, and they contacted me right away when they found out that I had a membership group on Facebook. And both says, we want to try to get the narrative and remove all these conspiracies out there, because our two pages were the ones drumming up all the conspiracies.
Right.
As far as what could – because there's no way this was an actual legitimate a deal. So something was fishy. But I thought it was fishy that they came to us right away, well, at the same time on their personal pages, by saying how much time they spent grieving over this horrible thing about their best friend dying in this horrible, tragic accident that happened to the wife that they know so well and the daughter that they all knew so well. They were all one big, happy family. But right. at the same time, they were contacting us as admins, as the admins of the page, Thomas and myself and these different pages.
Saying, we're not happy with you.
we don't like all these conspiracy theories and all this conjecture and opinion of what may have happened. I said, well, I don't know how I can help you out there on my page, because it's a wide open, basically it's a public forum for people to come and gather information on the case and come to their own conclusion. Same thing with Thomas. And they said, well, that's not going to work. You need to give us administrative access so we can start controlling what's being said out there. So okay. Thomas says, yes. He said, that sounds good. I'll create a couple people as moderators to the page, and a couple people as administrators, and I'll stay on because it's so busy moderating these comments and things that are coming out to kind of monitor it. But yes, I'll assign a couple of you at administrative access rights. Well, once he gave him rights to the page, a couple of the individuals came on and deleted large segments of threads and very interesting threads and topics and photos and images and screenshots, basically, you know, evidence of this case.
Right.
They weren't moderating it and kind of approving and non-approving members coming in as far as who could join, but
they were scrubbing
actual scrubbing data.
Right.
And so he found out just like that in a matter of an hour that that they did not have good intentions for what they were doing. He contacted me and says, you know, they just got done ringing me through the ropes, and I fell bait. I fell into it. I gave them access. They're going to be coming for yours next. So just a heads up, don't grant them anything, because right. they're not going to use it to monitor. They're going to use it to censor. And it was very interesting because the Gray State Project and David Crowley was their whole mantra, their whole thing that they talked about was how to be open, how to be transparent. We're going up against the censorship of the bad guys, like what we're seeing now with the Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, all the censoring that's going on.
Right.
David Crowley and his group and his buddies were all about transparency and how to be open. And so we both thought it was odd, Thomas and myself, that, you know, why are they looking to censor something about their best friend? So the calls came in to me, the emails and the instant messages saying, give a couple of us administrative rights or moderator rights, or to at least be able to monitor some of this stuff. We know that you work during the day. There's so many members coming in. We don't want you making this a full-time job. We could ease the job by volunteering our time to help you out.
Right.
And first thing I said was, no, I'm handling it just fine myself. Well, that didn't sit well. Well, how about, well, can we be a moderator then? I said, no. Can you give us right to be an admin? I said, no. I said, I know from reading your posts about the Gray State guys that you guys are so busy grieving and trying to plan, setting up the plans for the memorial. You know, it's really hard to even think. I said, it's still too raw for you. It all happened just a few days ago, and I'll take it on. I'm not interested in your help. I'm not even a fan. I didn't even know David Crowley as a person or fan before this happened. Well, that's when they really got angry. As far as now, I'm not going to play ball with them, and now I'm fighting these guys. The guys that I like and trust and you know, respect for what they're doing in the real world are the ones that I'm like, well, now I don't know if I how much respect I have for you guys. So they wanted to take the page down and delete it then. And they said, don't worry, we'll find a way. We got hackers. We're good buddies with Anonymous and the Anons, and we could get in and pull your whole page down and leave you scrambling. And I said, well, that's interesting. That's fine. But you realize I'm looking for justice. We're looking for justice in this case.
Right.
How could you be against that? And so the next thing, they just finally got the day later, the memorial date is set up. They're going to have the funeral for David Crowley. And I said, that's fine, guys. I'll look forward to seeing you there. We can talk about it in person if we need to. And they said, don't even end up showing your face. You will be escorted out of that memorial if you dare show your face at that. So I took that now almost as a threat. Why wouldn't you want me there? What did I do?
Yeah.
So they went after Thomas's page. They went after mine. And it got very heated very quickly, and it got very escalated. And so in the next 2 weeks, there was hit pieces written about me and Thomas. Both, you know, did they plan to do this page together? Did they plan to do this and to railroad the whole justice crowd? And we're like, no, we are the justice crowd.
Exactly.
And another set of folks said, hey, these two worked very heavily on Sandy Hook, on exposing that. Maybe they're hoaxers. Maybe they didn't think the children died at the school. I said, well, I never said that. They said, maybe these two are hoaxers and they're part of the Alex Jones tinfoil hat crowd. So they put us together and called us the Sandy Hook hoaxers, you know, that they shouldn't have any credibility because of what they'd done in that case.
Right. Wow.
So they went after Thomas. They went after me. And after it was a couple days later that I got members of my family, got instant messages from these guys and the various threats that were coming up by saying, tell him to shut his mouth and shut this page down because it's ruining all of our lives. And so at this point, we realized that it may not have been a government hit. It may not have been an assassination with paid assassins, because at the same time, more information was coming out on the case, and we started seeing how sloppy it was done. Now, I've covered some of these other cases with Philip Marshall, the airline pilot who was exposing 9/11 truth.
Yes.
Saying that from a pilot's perspective, the things acclaimed that were supposedly done in 9/11 could not have happened. And then they found him and his two teenage children dead with a single gunshot to the head, and the dog cowering in the closet shot also. You know, a professional hit that took place in Calaveras County, California, just months before this took place. So I was thinking at first it may be something like that, where they blamed it on a distraught dad. In that case, they said he was distraught, in debt, and his life wasn't working right. He killed his family. Well, Philip Marshall was working on a new book on 9/11. A new transcript was just being sent out. He's ready to publish it. And he was on disability from work as an airline pilot from United for many years and was making pretty good money on disability that he didn't need to work or write books. He was trying to get the truth out. So
exactly.
Those facts we also saw that were wrong. In investigating this case, the first thing that the Gray State group or the Gray State Project guy says was David Crowley was down, depressed, and after finding out he was never going to get a contract deal. This was never going to pitch. No Hollywood producer would ever buy it. He didn't have a job, and now he sunk all this money into this, and he sunk into a depression and killed his family. Well, part of my investigation in covering this case, as I'm an accountant by trade, so I looked into the money trail first and started gathering the bank statements, the records, what they were living on, how much they were making. And he had a couple side businesses that were doing well. He had this that was doing well, but he didn't have a lot of expenses really either. So his wife was working full time, and they were sending a their daughter to a fairly expensive preschool in town, a private preschool. So there was a lot of things that didn't make sense to that either. Then I got in contact with the film company and the producers of the executives that said that they did have a contract with David. I said, well, that doesn't sound right. I don't like this he said, she said.
Exactly.
I'm going to do an interview live with you on the air and publish it on my YouTube channel, which at that time was growing because we were putting together YouTube videos once a week and once every other week on this Crowley case alone, and people were flocking to it to see all the things that we found behind the scenes. There's a lot of things on David Crowley's, you know, personal Facebook page that were deleted off of his page as well. So a lot of nefarious things were going on. The police department didn't seem like they were doing their job. It seemed to have been covered up by the police captain. David's family wasn't certainly helping out. It's almost as seemed they were going along with the official narrative, which I found, you know, any father and mother hard to believe that they would believe their son would have done this atrocity.
Exactly.
And so we started hitting grooves like that that started to get more and more members to the group and people and viewers and sets of eyes to watch the page. Well, I got that interview with the president of Michael Entertainment Group and talked to the president himself and says, we had a contract. We had signed it. We were moving forward with producing it. No one at the big level of Hollywood was going to fund a movie like this. You know, Warner Brothers, you know, a big production house, but we were more of a mid-sized group that could do it. And we're going to go with a budget, you know, a movie film budget of $30 million to get this filmed and produced and out into the theaters.
Right.
Well, $30 million is not big money, but a good size for a normal movie, feature movie in the theaters.
Well, that's what I'm thinking, Dan, because you think that look what David did with only like, you know, a few thousand dollars when he did that trailer. Could you imagine if they would have gave him $30 million to make this movie or a series or whatever? Like the one thing I can say about David, he could definitely work with a budget and a limited amount of money and crank out a really good product. So I would have really liked to see if he would have had that type of money, what he could have come out with. I think it would have been incredible because he definitely didn't have a lot of money to shoot this trailer, and he did an amazing job on it. It's Hollywood quality, in my opinion. I mean, it looks like a Hollywood trailer when you see it. So can you imagine if he would have got the money to do this? It would have been incredible.
I think it would have been incredible, and it would have you know, really woken a bunch of people up. It would have been a great a red pill movie, almost like a Matrix kind of a thing, for what it was trying to sell, not the sci-fi part of it, but it was a fictional movie about the pending doom here in America, and it took place in Minneapolis, St. Paul. So he did it real close to home, filmed it as if this was taking place with FEMA camps and military police coming in and the you know, the government having problems and the citizens, you know, pushing back, revolting.
Right, like martial law. Like he was, yeah, martial law.
What we're seeing, you know, now in today's world with the protests and the massive protests and the exposure of the corrupt governments worldwide, not just ours, but countries around the globe. So he was predicting a lot of things as far as this and things that happened 5-6 years ago are coming true now. So people are going as far as to saying that he's very, very prophetic from the prophecies that he was talking about. Well,
right.
Whether or not we believe in that, he was right because there's a lot of other groups out there saying the same thing, and he was pinpoint on. But they hear this $30 million now, Rick, and then we had, you know, we get all these conspiracy folks coming to our page. Some of the good kind and some of the kind of the wild, outlandish kind. So
for sure,
some were thinking that, boy, if he got that $30 million deal, if they cut him a check for $30 million, maybe he faked his death and split. Him and his wife and kid are living in an island. So all these other new conspiracies came into the mix that we had to now fend off.
Right.
And now we had to start not censoring, but clearing the story, making sure everyone's online with the facts. And so by this time, the membership had grown so big, I had gotten my friend Greg Fernandez Jr. to help be a moderator on my group and say, you know, we got to start setting the story straight on some of these things. I had talked to Comel's father on a phone call. I had been instant messaging with his sister and speaking with, you know, family and friends and things like this. So we were getting some good information out to the public that the police were not uncovering at all. But along with it came,
interesting,
you know, the crazies and everything else. But we says, no, if they would have gotten a $30 million deal, that would have been the budget to fund for producing, of hiring the staff and paying everybody to get a movie made. This would not falling into David Crowley's pocketbook. He would not have become a millionaire from making this. He probably would have made a good chunk of change. But like you said, David was very good in doing financials, very good at staying within a budget, very good at crossing his I's, dotting his I's and crossing his T's, which means when he was getting all this set up, he was going through legal and attorneys to get things set up properly.
Exactly. He was.
Among the way, he had created a couple of side businesses. He was selling used police and military gear from the military and recycling it and using it kind of for casting and movie purposes as props, and was doing this as a side business. And he had a buddy named Mitch Heil that he was in high school with, that he started this company with. And he was bound to terms, contractual terms with him. And then he started this other company with the Gray State and writing, producing, and directing with Danny August Mason. And he was a co-founder of that with him. And so he had business attachments with two other people while at the same time winning and getting this contract to move forward with the script. Now, his attorney in Minneapolis says the first thing you need to do before you start signing paperwork is to cut your business ties with these two, just so they don't come out and get you later, or so they don't have any brush ups now.
He's
selling this other military equipment. He said it doesn't relate to the movie we're making, and this piece with Danny August Mason that he's with the Gray State. He says try to get your ties cut, so you're send them a release. Legal release saying you're going to be making a movie, and once they sign off the rights, they're not going to come after and try to sue you later. And so Danny August Mason was hesitant on signing away his release, and he talked and worked with David about being a character, you know, maybe not being on the business end of it, but a character in the film and being the lead character in this Hollywood movie. So he was all set on that. This Mitch Heil and his other business didn't have any investment in whatever David was doing, and he signed it away, and everything was done. So
it was just Danny hanging on to his end of it.
Well, what we see here is, and we got the documentation that shows that Mitch Heil signed his piece from the attorney and says, I'm cutting ties with you from a business standpoint. If I make a $30 million movie, you're not going to come after me later and say, look, I was a part of that. Danny August Mason, there's emails going back and forth with Danny, with David Crowley, sending reminders about every month. He'd say, did you sign that form yet? Can you get it back to me? All you need to do is sign it. Get an attorney involved if you need it. Scan it. Send me back your signed copy in the form of a PDF, and I'll shoot it off to my attorney, and we'll get the ball rolling. Well, at the same time, his producers for the movie wanted to get going with hiring a cast, setting up location, film shots, film shoots, locations for this movie, but they couldn't, because they were waiting on this last thing to be signed.
Right.
And so this happened in July. I guess he got the contract for this movie in July or August. And then August, he sent out the paperwork right away. He's very good. You can see on emails from David coming out and coming in that he was very forthright on any kind of emails and very professional as far as, I'm looking for the answer on this. Do you have a time when we're done? And then in October, Danny August Mason says, I haven't looked at it yet, but I'm going to need to get my attorney involved to look at this.
Okay.
And David Crowley writes back, that's fine. That's what I mentioned from the beginning. I'm not doing anything behind your back. I just want you to sign this so we don't have any problems down the road.
And he was still trying to even assure Danny, from what the research I'd done, that he was still going to try to keep Danny. If Danny signed off, David was still going to try to keep Danny, get him a part in the movie, still be an actor in the movie, because I remember saying that to Danny, like, yeah, you're signing away your rights to this movie, but I'm still going to try to include you, at least to be an actor or fit you in there somewhere.
Here's what I think the easiest way to explain it, Rick, because this question comes up a lot as well. I think that Danny August Mason refused to sign that letter because I think he thought that he was being railroaded by David Crowley and writing him off.
Right.
What he meant that the legal paperwork was from a business standpoint, that you don't have a tie from being an officer, a board of directors, a management position, an employee of this company. Yes, mm-hmm. you could be a crew member. Yes, you can be an actor working on the film project. I got no beef with that. But I want to make sure that you're out from a business dealing so I can work with my new business contacts in Hollywood and my new attorneys that I'm going to be working with going forward. I got no problem with you being a crew, an actor, the main actor, the lead actor, you know, whatever. That's right. Not what this is. And I think Danny August Mason took that wrong because he refused to sign it. November comes around. This is 2013. David says, I got to get moving. I got to set a deadline for you. He sends an email saying December 16th, let me know what your answer is. Either you're not going to sign it or you are, but either way, I'm moving ahead to get this movie done because I can't wait around for you. And so there's some line of thinking out there that Danny August Mason wanted to be on the business side of deal, wanted to be on the administration side, that if this does make, maybe it grosses $60 million in the theaters and it took $30 million to make, you would now get a percentage of the proceeds. And he was looking to get rich. Danny August Mason was kind of dabbling in a modeling career, kind of dabbling in an acting career, was not really making ends meet on both things. So he was really all in on the Grace Dade project. So he was really offended, I think, when he got asked to sign that. Well, December 16th came and went. He didn't sign it. And David's last email to him says, you know, I still can work on getting you a part in the film. They had sent – by this time, they had said they were going to get their own staff, their own crew, their own actors. In fact, David Crowley was not even going to be the director himself, and David signed off on that. At first, I think he was going to be actually – sitting in the director's chair doing this film. They said, no, we've got to take this to a high level person to direct it, but you'd stay on, you know, in a consulting role. But they said, Danny August Mason is not going to be an actor. We got to fill that role with a Brad Pitt, a high end actor in the film, a Matt Damon. I'm just exaggerating here, but they said a top flight actor. So
Danny
already knew that he wasn't going to be in any of it now, so he didn't sign off on it. And I think that he was either hoping maybe that David Crowley was going to let it go, or that they could have worked out a side deal, but he just stuck his heels in the ground and said, I'm not going to sign it. So 2 weeks later, the bodies are all found dead, and now people are putting this together in the timeline by saying, you know, did Danny August Mason, did this piss him off enough that he would have killed for it? Well, I don't think so, but it could have been, because now he had motive.
It's something to look at, right?
It's something to look at. Now, if the Grace Dade guys as a project were thinking of maybe being part of this $30 million deal, you're dealing with guys that don't have full-time jobs and are scratching for money. They were all going to be left in the dust. So David, at least at this point, had some emails and some writings and whatnot in various emails that says that I'm looking forward to getting a new group of people, as I found that my inner circle is filled with, I think he said either snakes or it's snakes. Irresponsible. Yeah, snakes.
Yeah,
he snakes. Said he found out that he was in dealing with some bad eggs in his own very own personal inner circle.
Right.
So he made that clear. That was one of his Facebook pages posts that he wrote before the deaths was, I'm looking forward to getting a new group of friends, because the ones I had weren't serving me too well. And so the Grace Dade group guys knew this. And there's talk too that, you know, were they in on this? Did they think, look, we can't get a $30 million deal because that's David's, but if he's dead and we get the script, maybe we could sell it to our producers for a $15 million project or 20, you know, something less, but maybe we can still take it and run with it. The problem is David went ahead as diligent as he was from being a business dealing and a businessman and a financial guy. He also said that, I just lost my train of thought now. He knew he had to get rid of these guys and get in with a new set and move forward. because he found out that there were snakes within his own group that were looking to benefit.
Right.
Him. You know, David was a truth teller. He was not out there to make money. He was not out to get rich quick. He was not out there to become famous. He was charismatic, but he was out there to get the truth out about what's going on in this world. And so he knew that he had to cut ties with a lot of these things and move forward. Now, the problem is, here's the good thing, which I just thought of now, is David registered that script in his name.
Right. I was going to say that.
And got a copyright on it and registered it with – he was with the Screen Actors Guild. He had a membership in Hollywood, in the SAG, the SAG. So he was a membership there, and he put this script on and made sure it was in his name. And I'm not sure if he had a will or his life insurance or whatnot, but if they would have killed him – That script belonged to David. And so if you get down to the heirs of, let's say they did have an issue with David, and did kill him. Well, the script, if that's the thing that's got the value, if that's the thing that has a $30 million price tag potentially on it as far as a fair market value for that script,
if David gets it's killed, not going to go to Danny, that's for sure. Right, exactly.
If Mel gets killed and David gets killed, it's going to go down to the daughter, Rania, who is 5 years old, innocent 5 year old with nothing to gain or lose. So
right.
They knew, well, this is now supposition. You have to assume that the police, after not doing their job or maybe being told not to do the job, is who has the most to gain, who is set up to benefit
right.
from a death. And right now, obviously it wasn't David, Comel, or Rania. But it'd be David's family or Kamel's family that would be sitting on that Gray State script next.
Now, that's very true. Let me we're just getting to the top of the hour here almost, Dan. So we'll continue right after the break. I just want to let everyone know, that we will be, diving into more of this right after the break. I just want to let everyone know we're listener supported here, guys. I always like to say that because I think it's so important. That if you can, that you help, you know, donate to the channel or to the station, I should say. I always say channel. I apologize to the station. Whatever you can, because as we all are learning the hard way, freedom is being silenced. Our freedom of speech is being silenced. So it's definitely something that I really truly believe it's something to support and to keep going. A lot of great hosts on here. We cover tons of great topics, and I just think it's a great thing to support. So guys, if you can, please donate. Every little dollar is appreciated, and it all goes to a great use. We'll see you guys after the break with Dan Hennen.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Still men out there. God damn. When I go home, people ask me, "Hey, Hoot, why do you do it, man? Why? Some kind of war junkie?" I won't say a goddamn word. Why? They won't understand. They won't understand why we do it. They won't understand it's about the men next to you. And that's it. That's all it is.
Revolution Radio. Freedomslips.com. Number one listener supporter radio. The printing press for freedom. At a time when freedom is needed the most.
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
I will defend myself against their tyranny. Number three is my radio broadcast. I'm squarely in front of the public all the time, and they all know what's going on.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on for expanding its sphere of influence.
Hello, my name is John Wayne, and I do a broadcast here at freedomslips.com, revolution.radio, called The Unequivocal Truth, DEFCON 1.
Freedom and fear are at war.
And folks, I assure you, we are in Defense Condition 1, Mission 1, as we journey perilously through this paradigm that we currently reside in. And I ask that you join me every Saturday, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, for the unequivocal truth, DEFCON 1.
We'll never surrender.
The original machine had a base plate of prefamulated amulite surmounted by a malleable logarithmic casing in such a way that the two swerving bearings were in a direct line with a panometric fan. The lineup consisted simply of six hydrocoptic Marzal vanes, so fitted to the ambifacient lunar wane shaft that side fumbling was effectively prevented. The main winding was of the normal Lotus O deltoid type placed in canandermic semi-voloid slots of the stator, every seventh conductor being connected by a non-reversible tremie pipe to the differential girdle spring on the up end of the grand meters.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio, taking the confusion out of transmutated lunar girdle springs for 4 years and running. Revolution Radio, the number one listener-supported alternative media radio on the planet.
All right, thanks for listening while we take this short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Well, welcome back, everybody. Hope you guys had a good break. Got to get yourself up there, get a stretch, make a coffee, do whatever you got to do. And just letting everyone know that we are here speaking with Mr. Dan Henning, and we are covering the David Crowley case, which involves, some say, a triple murder, some say a murder-suicide. You know, a lot of people have their own different opinions on this case. And so we got Dan Henning here with us, and he's breaking down how he started the Facebook page and started looking into this case, because as with a lot of other people that have looked into this case, this, the story that they're spinning to the public just doesn't sit right with a lot of people. Now, before the break, Dan, we were talking about, we were leading up to how Danny August Mason did not ever sign away his rights to the movie. And I was saying to you on the break that what I think we should also mention is that there wasn't just one script that David wrote for The Gray State, that there was actually three scripts that I know of. I've read all three of them, and that the trailer that we, that people can see on YouTube is very different from the third script that he was going to, that he was pitching to Hollywood and that was going on. And I think that third script was very much David's work, and there wasn't many other people adding their work into it and stuff like that. So I know a lot of people are probably thinking, I've had people say, well, they can understand why Danny is upset for trying to sign away his rights, and he's put a lot of work into this, which I do understand. I mean, if, you know, you're volunteering your time and you're helping somebody and then they want to write you out, I kind of get it. But I think people should realize that the script, that I don't think Danny had really much to do with that script that David was selling to Hollywood and trying to get made. What do you think?
Well, that's a good point, Rick. He did have multiple scripts as far as versions, and there was multiple versions of that.
Right.
Now, David, well, it's twofold here. One is David was a perfectionist, so he was, you know, he wanted the script to be perfect. Exactly. And so he was a perfectionist. So he strived for accuracy and wanted it to be perfect. Now, he also went out and hired a Hollywood script reader and a consultant. I think this woman that he's using to read was based in Colorado, but it was a professional person that reads scripts for a living and tells them which direction to go, where it could be beefed up, helped along, and basically a consultant, or essentially if you're writing an essay in your high school class, your teacher would say, you know what, work on this a little more, take a little bit of this off, and there's a little too much fluff over here as a consultant. So he had an actual consultant working on it, which also were derived changes from as well to beef up that script. And yes, by the time it was done, the final version was very different than that trailer. Now, the trailer was very good. I'm sure all these scripts, if turned into a movie, all of them would have been very good. But yes, as a perfectionist, he was looking to change and alter. And by the time that was done, Danny August Mason was really written out and not really – David wasn't asking for help or assistance.
Exactly.
Or assistance of anything. He was kind of phasing him out. So I think Danny August Mason thought that he was being double-crossed by David Crowley after helping him get into all this and getting him into art school, into his background in cinematography. Is basically was Danny August Mason who did all that. So right. He was felt betrayed now, I think, at this point, although one could argue that's fair. David also was taking it into his own direction, and maybe that was fair.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. I mean, are you still with me? Oh, I don't know what happened to Dan. Dan, I can't hear you, but hopefully I can get him back. I don't think he dropped. It looks like he's still here. All right. Just can't hear you, Dan. I don't know if your microphone cut out or your computer. I don't know. So hopefully I can get Dan back here. I'm going to give him a couple minutes just to see if it's something on his end. I've never had this happen before, guys, but hopefully I can get Dan back on your talking. It sounded like he unplugged his mic cord or something like that, or his computer stopped. But so yeah, what do you guys, I mean, I'm trying to look at the chat here. What do you guys think about this Crowley case? I know that Dan's back. Okay, I was just about to ask in the chat there what they think of the case. Are you back with us?
Yeah, you know what? It just it just dropped off completely. It dropped the connection.
Wow.
So.
Okay, sorry about it. Well, it's great. I'm glad that you're back. That's perfect. So, I wanted to give you a couple minutes to get back. So, yeah, we were speaking about the final version of the script and that Danny kind of thought he was getting double-crossed and stuff like that. So I can see both sides, like you said. I can see Danny being upset and why, but I can also see David's point where if David's final script was his work, then he's going to want to take credit for it. I mean, it's just – that just makes sense.
Correct, and it's true. And now what this also leads is another dilemma in the police investigation. So the police investigation say it was closed and wrapped up. This was a double murder-suicide.
Right.
And because there's 40,000 population in the city of Apple Valley, Minnesota, they said the community is not – there's not a threat to the community as far as someone – a madman being out there. And so
right.
I had always contended that – but you don't know that. What if there is? If this was a triple murder, the killers are still walking free today. Now, this is what I said 7 years ago, and I believe it now wholeheartedly that the killers are walking free today, regardless of who they are. David did not do this. We've already found out. But in the course of the investigation, the detectives asked Danny August Mason, what is your role? How close are you to David? How close are you to the Gray State Project? And his answer, according to the police records, was, I'm nothing more than an actor. I don't have a role. I'm not a business associate or partner of David Crowley. That was his exact quote. So what we see now is a lie, because we know that Danny August Mason didn't sign over that. He was the co-founder of the Gray State.
Exactly.
He was. That's the thing that David Crowley was trying to get him off of his back, was a business partner from a business sense. So to authorities, he says directly, I was not a business. I had no business sense. I was not a partner. I was mainly an actor in his film, and that's all that I was. So he's trying to distance himself now to the investigators And I think he had to do that to help get them off his trail, because I think he's one of your suspects you'd have to look at in a case like this. Whether he carried out the killings or not, he would still be in a pool of suspects because of the means, motive, and opportunity for the crime and something to gain. Now that he's lying to investigators, that's another red flag. So Danny August Mason has since moved from the Twin Cities. He lives now in Austin, Texas, and has left the area. And the only thing that he's really said is that that we're a bunch of Looney Tunes and conspiracy theorists. But once again, if we're focusing on the facts, there's multiple scripts. David wanted to get Danny August Mason out of the way so he could move forward. That didn't happen. And now the family's found dead, and the script did end up in the Crowley's old man Crowley, the dad, and the brother. Now, what I was leading to before the break, David Crowley had a falling out with his brother. His brother is Dan Crowley Jr. His older brother. Yeah, he's older, but he's junior, but the dad is the senior. The dad has a strange connection in this whole investigation as well. The son, this Dan Crowley Jr.'s son, has a strange connection in this whole case. Connection number one is David and Danny and it's a lot of names here, and that's the other thing that gets people there's a lot of confusion. So it's David Crowley and Dan Crowley. Dan Crowley became good friends with Danny August Mason, and then Dan and David Crowley, the two brothers, had a huge falling out in the month of August. The bodies were found in this January. And the emails and the threats and David Crowley finding out that his inner circle was infested with snakes in the October-November timeframe, they hadn't been talking to each other since August. They were on non-speaking terms. This was serious stuff. We don't know what happened, but there was a big, big, big falling out with Dan and his brother David. Now, Dan, who wasn't talking, was very good with Danny August Mason. And they were on the side of the team that was trying to get that script. We know that they were trying to get the script, not from opinions, and not from conjecture to say that, hey, they did it. But in 2 months following, I think it was 3 months after the bodies were found, court business filings show that Danny August Mason created a company called Gray State Universe LLC. And he filed an attorney to get a script. Not a script as far as the text, as a movie script, but the official logo for Gray State, he wanted to get that trademark by an attorney so he could have the rights to that Gray State trademark logo.
Okay.
He went and got that file. That's not fake. That's not made up. That's not someone's opinion. He did that with the state of Minnesota, and he went with the Secretary of State to file a brand new business to be created called GrayStateUniverse.LLC. He created a Facebook page for that, and I think he was going to take – what was left of the Gray State and turned it into his own after getting the deal with that, getting the movie script in his hand. And so he actually went forward and made business decisions moving forward based on him having the rights to do that. Now, keep in mind, he told the investigators he had no business dealings, but he never signed off with his lawyer or his attorney to cut the ties. So technically, he still was a business partner of David's.
Exactly.
But I think after he, I think, did his talking with friends and buddies and was reading stuff on our page, they came to the conclusion that that script is not going to fall into his hands legally anyway. Now, because he had that registered, that script, the movie script registered with the Screen Actors Guild, it expired in the year 2019. I think it was June of 2019 that the rights were David Crowley's. They can't be just dropped off to the next person. The next person holding the script just doesn't now automatically own that script. So a few months later that year in 2016 was Danny August Mason just threw in the towel at creating these new businesses and logos and hiring attorneys and whatnot. So he knew he couldn't benefit. He couldn't get anything from it. But the fact they tried to get the script and the fact that he set up these companies to take the project forward to release the film and the movie and whatnot
is very telling.
They also knew there were different versions floating around of the script, and I don't think they cared at that point. They wanted to get their hands on one or more of them, even if it wasn't the right one, to move forward now and pitch it to executives to get this thing produced into a big movie so they would make money.
Right.
That's more. But so there was means and motive and opportunity and a benefit. You know, they could have benefited. And I think Dan Jr., Crowley Jr., could have benefited himself by getting that script. He could have landed a big piece of pie because he didn't have a job and was unemployed at the time as well and had a falling out. So it would have been a stretch to think he would have done something like that to his own brother. But
it's still worth looking into.
It's worth looking into, and it's worth talk. You know, it's something that investigators need to look into, things like that. And the investigation here for the Apple Valley Police didn't go that far. They didn't do some of this background checking. They didn't do the very basic elementary investigation. Later, we found out the bullet that killed David didn't tie to him and didn't have an ounce of blood or even a drop of blood or brain matter or brain tissue even on that bullet that they found.
That's one of the big things that really, there's a couple things in this case that really make me, like, it just makes me question it, because and it's definitely what you just talked about, which we can talk about a little bit more in depth, but the bullet that they found a month later, you know, conveniently in the attic with no blood on it, no tissue, no hair, there's touch DNA on it. And I even asked a friend of mine who's a gunsmith and knows bullets and knows weapons very well. And he said there would be no way that a hollow point bullet would go through somebody's head and then not have any trace of hair, tissue, anything on it. It would just come out clean and just have touch DNA on it. So that was strange. And then the bullet also that is in the floor that a lot of people say, well, David was shooting at the dog and he missed the dog and that's why there's a bullet in the floor. That I don't buy that one. I'm sorry, you're not going to sell me on that David was shooting at the dog and missed and then just decided to leave the dog alive. And, you know, it just doesn't – I don't buy that one. So I see where you're saying. Like, when you start digging into the evidence in this case and what was done and not done, that's when it really starts stacking up that makes you question what went on, like, for sure.
Yeah, and it's interesting enough because of how sloppy the case was. We have since ruled out the fact that it was professional paid assassins or government hitmen or anything to that effect. And that's one of the reasons I put that page together. That was the understanding or the assumption that this looked like a government hit of someone that was going to blow the whistle on us on a lot of government deals over the years. And they had to take him out. But after, you know, setting this page up and 5-6 years later, we realized that was not the case. These are not professionals whatsoever who committed this crime. These were amateurs. Now, as horrendous as it is, they're still amateurs. It doesn't mean they may have not have done this before or won't do it again. Right. But this is not a government-paid hitman who slyly came in and did it and slyly left, and it was a done deal. There was a lot of time spent in that house, which was another thing. So looking at the investigation, we see that there's a patio rear slider door left a quarter inch open in the middle of winter in Minnesota, January. That's odd. They never really looked into why that would be. And no forced entry into the home. You'd have to look at also as well as they must have the killers must have known the family or have been acquaintances of the family to let them in. And so – you know, there's all these other circumstances around there, but we try to stay focused on the facts and the facts only and lead us. Where do the facts lead us versus where do we want the narrative to go? We still don't know who did it or why, but we can put bullet points together as far as hypothesis, as far as best guesses, who did, what was the plan, what was the end game to pull off something this horrendous? And so, you know, a page like this really grows over the years. It really becomes good. So back to the Danny August Mason, he shut down his business plans with Gray State and finally, I think, came to the conclusion that nothing was going to come out of it anyway that he would benefit from.
Exactly.
And neither did the rest of the guys, so they all kind of went their own way. Now, in 2016, a year later, all the information comes out. There's the police report kind of finalizes. And then Greg and I both get a phone call about this documentary from A&E Films to come and do a documentary on this, on the David Crowley Gray State. And they really were taken in by the citizen journalists that the stuff that we were uncovering on the page. And they wanted to do a documentary. So Greg and I had two things. We were like, number one, this story needs a documentary made. This is unbelievable for a documentary to be made. A lot of people were putting together little videos, podcasts, and doing interviews, but it wasn't making the mainstream. It wasn't making any noise as far as the people in Apple Valley themselves were 4 years into this thing, and they weren't really still aware of the story either. Great. So
a documentary would be good if it was.
We thought be good. Great. I said this would be awesome to get out there because it could really spread the word. Greg Fernandez warned me by saying, "Well, you know, we might be the tools in this wood shop. You know, they're going to use us to make us look like conspiracy theorists." And I said, "Greg, here's what we need to do. I vote that we do it, not knowing what the end result's going to be.
Right.
Because this story getting out, regardless if it's a slanted propaganda piece or not, it's going to wake people up and it's going to get out there." So we both agree to do it. They send out a cast and crew from LA and interview me in my home and Greg in his home. And we thought they're going to be this big documentary, 2 to 3 hour documentary on how to solve a crime from a citizen armchair investigator format. Well, right. We find out 6 or 7 months later that they interviewed, 15, 20 different people for this film. They kept saying it's taking very long for the editing process to be done, and we'll keep you abreast of our opportunities and send you the updates when the preliminary version comes out and the file version comes out, and you'll be able to see all those things. Well, we didn't hear anything. Greg and I didn't hear anything until someone says, "Oh, the movie's out. It's going to be featured on A&E. It's going to be debuting on Christmas Day 2017. We said, "Well, I'd like to see this because we didn't get told anything about this."
That's weird.
We weren't looking to be the stars, but it was pitched to us that we'd be the leading two guys opening and cracking this case and then having some investigators take a look at it and get it out there on a Discovery ID channel, a true crimes kind of a story that could then take the ball and run with it and actually try to solve it. The movie comes out, Rick.
I know.
it's pushing the official narrative that David was a wisecrack, didn't know what he's talking about, went off the deep end and killed his family. And they said, but there's some conspiracy folks out there such as Greg and Dan, and they piped to us and cut over to us. They show us for maybe 30 seconds a piece, and then 30 seconds later on in the film, both doing things together, and they called us conspiracy theorists, kind of nut jobs. So they spin us the wrong way. It was a propaganda-based film. It went out, and they introduced that film into various Sundance film festivals and whatnot to try to win independent awards.
Right.
So then it gets sold and gets set up on Netflix, and it starts airing. It's out on Netflix to this day, Rick. Yeah. What we've seen is that since that airing of that in 2017, majority of people who watch that movie, that hit piece is what I'll call it. I don't like it, but I do like it for one reason. It's drawing people to our page because many people who watch it that are critical thinkers leave that movie and say that none of that added up to anything.
Right.
They're trying to sell it. It's a sales pitch to make you believe that David did it. And it doesn't present any evidence, but it spins conjecture.
Oh, for
all
sure.
90 minutes of the film.
I've watched that film, Dan, 3 times just because the first time I watched it, it left a really bad, the figure of speech taste in my mouth. So I was like, okay, I'm going to give it another chance. And I watched it again, and then I've watched it a 3rd time since. And yeah, you can tell right from the start that they are very definitely guiding you. They want you to go down a very certain path, and anyone, like you said, who's a critical thinker, you can see that a mile away. Like I could, like I was watching and I'm like, I see what they're trying to do here. They're trying to spin their narrative, and they are really hammering home any little point they can to make their reader believe that, and, or the viewer, I should say, believe that. And I agree with what you say. Ever since that, I call it a sloppy-mentary. A lot of people call it that too. And I know that exactly what you're saying is correct, that as soon as that came out and people started watching that, it's just drawn more attention to people looking into what really happened. I think it backfired on what they were trying to do.
Yeah, I would agree 100% because this was 2017, and during the entire year of 2018, we saw an increase in membership at our page, and a lot of locals, a lot of people from Apple Valley A lot of people from Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Minnesota alone all started joining this group. And I was able to conduct other interviews with new folks as well by saying, hey, I've got a background in this. I've got a background in that. I'm in forensics. I'm a former investigator. I'm a former retired police detective. Here's what's wrong with the case. So then we're able to really get a lot of people involved and do a lot of interviews with people with backgrounds in autopsies, people in backgrounds with, say, what's it called, FBI profilers. Who would have done something like this? You know, what would be that profile of a type of a killer that would be into doing something like this? So we were able to get a lot of experts on our shows, networks, and channels. While at the same time, Greg Fernandez, my partner in the Justice page, says, I'm going to write a book about this, and I'm going to deal with facts only. Only going to use quotes that people said to me or said in the press or said from the detective's mouths or from the police captain or whatever. And so in 2019, he publishes a book called The Gray Stage. And if you get a chance to look at it for the listeners out there, it's called The Gray Stage, written by Greg Fernandez Jr. It's published in 2019. And that has been the secondary most reason that we're getting all these members, because people are buying a bunch of the books online and sending them to their friends, relatives, loved ones, giving them as gifts and reading it. Now, what Greg has done, which I love, Greg says, I'm not out to make money. I have a job. I'm not out to sell the books, because he was getting a lot of grief saying he's going to sell this book to try to make some money because he can't do it anywhere else. He said, I'm going to make the PDF of the book available online for free. Mm-hmm. So actually right now there's a book in print that you can get. You can go to his website and buy the actual book if you want something physical, tangible in your hands. Or you can read the PDF version, download for free, available free, Rick, that has all the evidence case built out that there could be a real, I would repeat, real documentary made almost from the contents of Greg's book right here, because he spells out every aspect of the crime from a fact, evidence-based prospect only. There is no conjecture. There is no commentary. There's no opinion. And he asked me to write the foreword for this book, so I wrote the foreword, but it's out there. It's available. So between the Netflix movie or the sloppumentary, Greg Fernandez's book, which is very good, and the two websites that are up and running now as far as the Facebook, the Justice for David Crowley and Family, the page that I created that has almost 4,000 members 7 years ago, and the Justice for David Crowley of Gray State, which Thomas Lapp abandoned after about 2 years and had me take it over. He was on to other things. He was investigating other projects. I'm running that page myself.
Okay. I didn't realize that you were running both. So that, that's good. So that's do you know the web address for Greg's page where people can download the book and that? Do you have that handy?
I'll pull it up here during a show, but
Perfect.
Greg was able to run and moderate that Justice for David Crowley and Family Facebook group. That's actually a membership-based group. You have to be a member. And we've got three or four other very helpful moderators and editors that are following the posts, following the members when they come in, asking questions and things like that when things – so I don't really have to monitor that page that much. That's in very good hands, the folks running that page. I'm the only one really running the Justice for David Crowley of Gray State, which really handles the questions for David Crowley as a figure, as a Gray State project, for the fans. The real fans that are out there that have been following him for years are really the ones in that group too. And every time we do interviews, such as this, podcasts relating to the case, I'll post links out there as well. So that whole entire, it's a different audience, but there's more of them. I think there might be 10,000 likes out there on that group, but not 4,000 members, you know, active members on the page. But both of those Facebook groups are very are the lifeblood of this investigative case. No one has come forward to say, I'm going to do a documentary and get it right. We've had a couple folks say that, and I think they're well-meaning that they want to do it, but not anything as far as a high-level television network docuseries kind of a thing. I'm looking forward to getting any kind of a documentary out there about this case because of how strange it is. But I think it would have to be done in a 2 or 3 part series to digest.
I agree. I don't think you could. There's so much. I don't think. I found Greg. So if you want to get the book, people, anyone that wants to download the book, check it out, read it for yourself, and check out the page. It is thegraystagewordpress.com.
So he did it through WordPress, and he published the book himself. It's really well done, and it went through many versions of edits as well. It's a very clean, concise book. Not a lot of fluff, not a lot of extra information in there, and it's all facts. It's the quotes of someone who messaged him or emailed him or on the phone. In discussions we've had with the lead detective in the Apple Valley Police Department, all the quotes are actually all in there. And the rest of the book is the DNA analysis, the forensics.
That's a whole new
everything that you can think of that's pertinent to a case is in the Greg Fernandez book. And like I said, he's not out there trying to make a name for himself. He's trying to get the information out there, and that is a great source. We still do to this day, Rick, a monthly podcast on a chapter of that book.
Right.
And basically read it on the air and comment on it. There's a monthly podcast that goes out to everyone on his Spotify network and whatnot that goes over just him and I. We usually have some other guests on as well to talk about the case, but we go through that book every single page, and we do a couple podcasts on each chapter of that book, and we're not done yet, so.
Right. And that's great. And there's a lot of people, when you start looking into this case, that are still covering this case. I've done interviews with people on this case, and I know you have, and Greg definitely has, and Catherine Michelle has. Like, so many people are doing, really interested in this case. And I think that the reason that is that once, as I was saying at the beginning, Dan, that once you start looking into this case and looking at the evidence, and I've had people tell me, when I first started looking into it, that go to the police files, read the police reports, read the autopsy reports, and read all the journal, because there's a journal now, that David Crowley's journal, that you can access to read and stuff like that. And then, because these were people saying that David did it, and if I just read the police files, that I would see that David did it. And then I always respond, well, I did read the police files. I read everything I could on this case several times, and I have more questions now than I did before I read all the files. Like, that's where all my questions started coming from, because I'd like you to explain, a lot of stuff was not done in this case properly. Like, there's stuff that wasn't tested. It just doesn't make sense when you start digging into this case. And that's where all my questions came from, was actually reading the police reports and stuff. It's crazy.
Yeah, there's a lot out there, and you're spot on. For those who do come to the case with an interest, they tend to be addicted to it right off the bat for about a 2-week period, because they just try to absorb as much as they can. And many of them respond back on the Facebook group or on a personal message by saying, I didn't get much sleep the last couple of weeks because I just can't get this case out of my mind. It becomes addicting. But once you get over that phase and get into looking at all the details, the reports, the photographs, we were able to file – one thing we did, Rick, was file the FOIA requests for all these various things with the Minnesota, the BCA, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and the police department and the state of Minnesota. You know, all these files we got from the autopsy, the examination, and photographs, the crime scene photos. They wouldn't give us the gruesome ones, of course.
But it took you guys a long time to get all this information. This wasn't something that was gotten over a couple of years. You guys have been fighting to get this information every step of the way.
Well, it's been a battle, because one of us would supply a request and get, 80 pages. Another person would send a request and get, 95 pages, requesting the exact same thing. And then a couple of years later, someone made a request that wasn't even part of the main group, but was investigated in the case, and they sent me a couple CDs and says, we got, 480 pages of documentation that I got.
Wow.
And so we did a couple, months of just shows on interviews and shows and podcasts of just going through the new information that came out. Then we got into the other layers of things. And then people started coming forth with other things as well, too. Good guys in the case, by saying, I had a dealing with David. I don't have much to offer, but I got this letter that he sent me once, and I worked with him in the Army and the military. Here's what he was like, or I'm a relative member of the family. Here's what we went through. And so we've got these first person details of people to kind of put all this, the pieces together.
Right. Right.
And so it's a large piece of work, the entire facet of this entire deal. But like you said, we've able to get evidence of witnesses lying to police. We've gotten, we've got inconsistencies and lies in the police report themselves.
Exactly.
And we've got things that didn't happen that allegedly did happen, and we were able to get clues and investigations as far as cell phone records, text records that folks have said, you know, I texted David on this date, or I sent him an email on this date, and I made 5 phone calls. I couldn't get a hold of him. You know, we get those records in and do a double check. We cross-reference everything and say, you know what, these phone calls never came through. This text never was sent or received. Someone's lying.
Exactly.
And we got the phone numbers for all the phones and the pagers and everything that they had. And so now we get more lies coming into the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's wild. But there's a lot to think about. What I try to do and try to tell people is focus on the things that are important, not the things that are – you know, the peripheral things around the case that are kind of important, but you're going to get yourself stuck in a vicious cycle if you're going to look up the right stuff that really doesn't pertain. But like you said, the dog was left alive. The 3 people were dead. They were allegedly in that house for 2 or 3 weeks. The dog was not fed, was starving, and started eating on the humans. The bodies were now dismembered to some extent. And so, right. That's what the public thinks, is that the dog was hungry and started feeding on the bodies. But it's the other things you have to look at in a case like that. And so once we got the autopsy reports back, you know, one thing that was very much a focus for me was the missing arm of Rania. The 5-year-old girl had her right arm was missing.
Yes, and, yes.
They said, well,
Camille had her hands missing. David had a hand missing.
And David's right hand was missing, and that he was right-handed.
Yeah,
and the gun was laying. He was laying on his back, and the gun was a few inches away from his left hand. Well, yep. He was right-handed, and the gunshot came from the right side of his head, and the gun was laying by the left side. Camille's, both of her hands were missing, missing altogether. So, you know, did the dog eat just the hands? Well, if you tie it back and do the cross reference. Camille was lying on her belly with her arms crossed underneath her.
And right.
Basically, she was laying on her hands. In other words, the dog didn't have access to the hands. How could they be gone? Would the dog normally eat a more fleshy part of someone's body first, a stomach, a thigh, you know, if they were very hungry? Would they go to the hands? Would a dog ever eat hands full of bones?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of, too. I thought of that, too. Yeah, like
an entire arm off of a 5-year-old girl. You know, these are some of the questions that we had, but we get to the next step of the investigation, and we find the autopsy on the little girl shows a fractured rib just under her armpit on her right side where the arm was, almost like a bone was cracked or chipped or a rib was fractured if that arm was potentially yanked out or pulled out by a human person, whether
a lot of people say it was the dog. I mean, the dog gets – as you agree, Dan – yeah, the dog gets blamed for everything in this case. He really does.
The dog for everything. But the another key point of that is that the arm was missing from its socket. So not just the arm was missing, meaning it was bit off or chewed off, but it was out of the socket. Those are strong muscles in that shoulder socket that suck it in. In order to get that bone to come off, it needs to be pulled, yanked, driven out somehow with a lot of force, even on a 5-year-old girl. So that's not something a 25-pound beagle mix type of a dog would be doing.
Right.
You know,
right.
A pack of dogs, a pack of wild dogs, who knows what they would have done to these bodies. The thing that we've seen in the photographs, the things that we looked at, is we have 464 photographs of inside the house from the crime scene that were taken, the professional ones. And there's not a dog food, a dog dish or a water bowl in that house. Now, we know anyone who owns a home or a house has a water dish for the dog to drink and a food dish for the dog to eat.
Right.
Those were taken out or removed from the house. So, obviously, David or Camille didn't do that. But if someone took them out, that's going to force the dog to scavenge on the bodies. correct. So you have to look at the thinking that goes into an investigation like this. You can't just take things at face value. You have to think, why is there not a water dish? Why is there not a food dish? The dog was meant to be eating and scavenging on those bodies because he was destroying evidence
exactly
of the body. So that was all meant, you know, well played by the killers to do certain things like that.
They threw, like, that's what kind of tipped me off with this case too, Dan, is they just threw so much out there, like, to distract people. Like, like you said, they had the dog there. Then they got the blood writing on the wall, the Allahu Akbar written on the wall above the couch. And so they got that's written in Kamel's blood. Then they got it, like, I love the way Gray calls it the gray stage, because whether David did it or not, it was staged. No matter, so we can all agree on that. And I mean, having his playlist play on the laptop when people walk into the room, when the police walk into the room and stuff like that. And it's just crazy and then you also got the Quran on the floor ripped apart and stuff. So that's what I'm trying to let people know, is that when you start looking at this case, it's like they threw everything they could to distract people into this case, like just throw everything at them. And it's crazy when you start digging into it.
I think that the real killers or the real perpetrators would have been more successful if they would have throttled back on the staging.
They probably
would have gotten away with this. They probably would have gotten away very easy on a case like this. But when you go overboard, when there's the overkill involved, we know Rania was killed with one shot to the back of the head. David was shot with one shot to the head. But Kamel had three gunshots to the back of her head and three bullets that had that her blood and her DNA and brain matter and tissue on. So if this was a hit, there'd be no need for killing three times. But someone who did it or someone was part of it, there was a definite Muslim angle, I think, a religious. They went after her. She and her family grew up in Pakistan and then moved to the United States. And so she was of Muslim belief. And so on the wall, we get this blood writing that says Allah Akbar.
Mm-hmm.
At the scene of the crime on the living room floor is a Quran. A Quran opened up, bloody pages torn out. And a notepad in David's office has a message that says, bow to, what does it say? Bow to Allah now?
Submit to Allah.
Submit to Allah now.
Yeah,
so there's three things that tie back to the Muslim angle and the fact that Kamel was killed three times. So I think someone, a member of the killing team, did have a Muslim bias, or not racist, but a religious bias that did not like people of the Muslim faith. And maybe it was because the arm was, pulled off two of the little girl. Nothing was done with David. It's just a simple gunshot to the head, and he was a white male Caucasian. But the extreme cases that were done in this were to those of the Muslim faith. And in the Muslim blood, the blood on the wall was all Kamel's.
Yeah, which makes no sense with the blood on the wall, because there's no blood leading, like blood drops leading up to, like, on the couch or like underneath the writing or anything. It was just, it's really strange. Like, I just, there's so not enough blood around for this amount.
And David, as far as his handwriting, everything he writes, very much a writer, as far as he was very artistic and wrote a lot of things down and took a lot of notes. And everything he wrote was in lowercase or cursive. And then you get this blood on the wall written in block letters, almost looks like by a left-handed person, the marks look. And so it's very, David's right-handed once again, and there was no fingerprints there. So it looks like gloves or latex gloves were used, and that they were also taken from the scene. There was no latex gloves or dirty gloves in a garbage anywhere. And,
what's really crazy too, Dan, is that tell people about the gun, that there's no – like, you think a gun, if David did this, his fingerprints should be all over that gun, like everywhere. I mean,
he bought a gun and then took Kamel training and then bought a couple of handguns, I think he had in the house, and then Kamel did too, and they were working with firearms safety and trainers and whatnot.
Right.
They were very well disciplined with their firearms. They knew how to load it, how to clean it, how to take care of it. They really took pride in their weapons. And so, of course, you get three people dead. The investigators come in and let's look at the fingerprints. Let's look at the DNA. Well, there's no prints. There's no prints on that gun. There's no fingerprints on the weapon. Well, the only time you see a fingerprintless weapon is it's when it's been wiped down. So wouldn't that pique the curiosity of the investigators to say that, you know, it's kind of strange that there are no fingerprints. Now there's a,
right,
a palm print or a thumb print, and then there is some blood mixture of David on some of the scenes in the living room there. Some have Kamel's blood, some have Rania's blood, and there's one instance where there's a mixture of blood of Kamel and David's along with a fourth person.
Right.
You know, there's another person's blood in the mix at that house that investigators never looked at at all.
Never looked at.
Why would more than three people be bleeding in a triple homicide? Who's the blood of the fourth person? They also found a knife at the scene. You know, the
which had all three of their blood on it when they
very strange. Yeah, it looked like the family that the three there were either tortured or abused or mutilated first and then killed later.
Right. And they never do explain why that knife is there. Like, they kind of just gloss over the whole knife thing. And I'm like, why is there even an open knife in this if it was a murder-suicide? Like, it shouldn't be there.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that really don't make sense. So it got out that, you know, the story was that they were in troubling times. David and Kamel were arguing. They were going to leave. They were going to get separated. Mm-hmm. David was depressed about the contract that he didn't win on this big the script for his movie rights for the big deal. Well, we found out that, you know, there was no truth to that because he did have a movie deal. The only people telling us there was no movie deal and David was despondent about not getting it was the guys in the gray state, his fellow snakes in the grass. The only ones who were saying that. And then we get an email from a real estate agent in California saying, oh, yeah, they came and looked at – they're looking at homes in the area to buy. David and Kamel both were looking at homes once this movie and everything got set and done and got into place. They had a little more money. He was looking to move into the Hollywood area to live, to be in that scene, to be in that setting and get out of Minnesota. So is that something David and Kamel, if they were struggling, would be doing? Their daughter was enrolled in school. They loved her. They did everything with her. They were very bonded as a three-person unit. They started, you know, pulling away from these creeps that didn't have the best interests at heart. But how that got spun, Rick, it got spun in the investigation is that they were both being despondent and falling away and becoming out of touch with reality is how it got spun.
Right. And again, Dave, and that's another thing that people should really look into, Dan, is the journal, because I found the journal was very telling. Now, I do admit that you can't, you know, journals are very deceptive because you're looking at one brief moment in somebody's life that they're writing down. And I mean, the whole something could change within the next 5 minutes after they write that. They're writing their feelings down at that moment. And I know a lot of people say that David's talking, you know, and I've never heard anyone say that David was a perfect person, was a perfect man, didn't have his flaws like all of us. And you can see that in the journal. Yes, he's struggling with being a father and connecting to his daughter at first when he gets back from his second deployment. But you also see in the journal where he's working his way through this and making a lot of headway and coming to be happy to be a father and have a daughter. And, you know, he's working his way through it. And they don't spin – they try to spin it that he was pulling away from everybody and isolating. He was only pulling away from the people that he called snakes and that he was not, you know, happy with. It wasn't like he was pulling away from everybody.
Yeah, I think that he started seeing what was going on, the people that were his real friends versus the people that were his friends that were just really hanging on his coattails waiting for him to become rich and famous so that they could benefit. It was like almost like following a rock star on the rise to fame. You got these tag-alongs, these follow-alongers that were thinking, you know what, this guy will become famous one day. Let's ride this out. Let's get some of the wealth and then we can ditch him later on. And I think that's what he started finding out, that things weren't as they were on the up and up. And he started realizing that. So.
Yeah, I agree. And then when you watch that documentary, sloppymentary, whatever you want to call it, everybody claims to be David's best friend and they were so close and they knew him so well. But when you do read his journal, you find it very quickly that's not true. Like, they were not as close as they made themselves out to be in this documentary. He was definitely pulling away from these people. And it's just weird how in that documentary that I found, that was something that really bothered me, is that they were all so close to David and knew him so well and
they were getting along, they were brothers, and I'm thinking, like, that's not the way he was talking about them in his journal.
Like, that's a very good point, because in public, in the aftermath of this murder, David had like 15 best friends that all appeared on TV channels and interviews, and very close, and he didn't do anything without me, and we were buddies, and we were brothers, and we did it all, we were best friends. And then you find out that wasn't the case. So you're only left to assume one thing is, why are you trying to spin a narrative? Why are you selling propaganda now to us to make us believe that? If you've got nothing to hide, why is there lies at all? And now why is there mistruths at all? And David was slowly pulling himself away because he started finding things out. I mean, his own family, you know, he didn't talk with his father. I mean, said on an investigation, on the police investigation, says, I tried to reach out to him for Thanksgiving, and David said he was not interested. David said he was bummed out about not getting the deal for the contract for the movie. And the dates that he says that he reached out on a text and phone calls, those of us in the group that went back and retied out those, cross-referenced those phone calls and texts, say those never took place either. The very phone calls from his father did not take place. Now, his parents were divorced, living in the same town in Owatonna, Minnesota, 45 minutes away. And there's strange things with his own family dynamic, David's family. The parents were divorced, and the mother was very close with David, very close. The dad was somewhat, I think, you get a little – a feeling that a little more distant, but he was very,
right.
I think, close with his mother. She was living by herself and was dating someone, and then she died. It was 7 months after the bodies were found. They found her body 7 months later, and she was, coincidentally enough, one of the only people in the whole case who didn't buy this double murder-suicide story. And they found her dead. She had bouts with alcoholism and had some medical issues, but not medical issues as if she was, you know, gravely ill. She was working two jobs, was fit, was in shape, was actively dating, and worked two jobs. And, you know, she said, as a mother knows her son, and she said, I just can't get over this hump of this actually taking place. And so when her death comes up, it spawned another whole new set of conspiracy theories. But I'm one to believe that they're not really so far out there. I find it highly unlikely that her mother would coincidentally wind up dead as well as David within a year. So, you know, a lot of these things are suspect, but we're hoping, you know, word gets out, they can follow this case and get more information. And hopefully when a true documentary comes out about this, it could blow the case open. We're hoping the investigation actually gets reopened into the murder case.
Then, yeah, you guys have been trying to do that for the last 7 years, and that's what I like about what you say, Dan, is like you always, and I've heard everybody, Greg, say this, and everybody, that, you know, don't listen just to you guys, to, you know, do your own research, and you guys provide all the links and all the, you can get all the information you guys have. You guys make it very, very available for everybody to go and read themselves. You can get on Greg's site, you can get this book, you can get the police reports, the BCA reports, the journal, everything that you guys have read, you know, autopsy reports, pictures, everything you guys make available for people to go and research. And you always tell people, and I tell people in every interview that I do on this case, do your own research. Like, don't just listen to one person and run with it. And I've heard you say that too. And I've heard Greg say that. Do your own research. Come to your own conclusion, but you know, you have to look into it yourself. There's a lot to go through. It really is.
There's a lot of things, you know, downloadable that we have on the justice page. There's a whole section for files that you can go there and download. Once again, it's all free. The stuff on my website too, I've got a section dedicated to the Crawley site on my website on the Crawley case. It's called uglytruth.info is my personal website.
Okay, perfect.
The ugly truth of some of these heinous crimes and corruption that we've been dealing with over the decades. And there's a prominent, you know, link for the David Crawley case right there. There's a snippet that you can download that says on audio that David Crawley said that he was not suicidal leading up to the months of that case. So he's on the record. You can download that or just listen to it yourself. But there's various footage and, you know, video and audio and documents that it's all available to download. And we've been trying to get it all together into one spot to get a master master spot. But there's a lot of it out there. Most of it's in duplicate and triplicate. So between all of us, we've got it all out there. But just
right.
Start hunting and pecking around, there's information that's very, very interesting out there. There's a couple – I mean, the police department themselves, we've been in contact with the lead detective. But that's not to say that we haven't had – emails or correspondence with other people as well. I've been waiting to do on a case like this, you have to kind of wait till police on the force get into retirement and then more apt to talk on a case like this. Now
it's seven
years later, and you still have to follow the city council news, the Apple Valley newspaper to see if someone's retiring, going into a new job, stepping down out of their role. They've been there 20, 30 years on the police force. And they're really bound to not say anything about a case while they're employed. I'm sure they hang that retirement fund over their head and use that as a threat to say, you can't talk about this case. We're going to start pulling things, benefits from you if you do. But once they retire and they're not connected to the force, they're available. And so I reached out with one individual, one of the detectives who was the first on the scene, one of the law enforcement. And he said he was interested in talking about the case. I said, I'd like to get some more details, nothing earth-shattering, but just your viewpoint. He was the gentleman that went around the back on the first on the scene and put into his audio on the 9/11 call and said onto the dispatch, the door is slightly ajar in the back. It's unlocked going into the house, and the house smells awful, human flesh decaying. When he retired, I said, I'd like to know a little bit more about that, not the gruesome stuff, but what was it like going to a case like this? The city of Apple Valley gets one homicide per year, as they average. Very low crime rate. And I would love to ask a gentleman like him, what's it like going to a scene where there's three dead bodies? What is that? When you're used to dealing with one a year,
right?
I stumble upon three.
I agree, Dan. Like that. Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, Dan. I'm just running out of time. I wish I had you for a third hour. I really do. But I would agree. I think that would be an amazing if you could speak to that gentleman, that police officer.
Just to wrap up, Rick.
Yep, you got one minute, Dan.
He initially said he would do it and wanted to meet for coffee. Then he talked to his boss later at the department and says, no, please don't call. Please don't talk to me. Don't reach out to me anymore. I'm not going to do anything for you. So that's how the things change. But that's a good summary of
For sure. Yeah, I want
2 hours.
Yeah, thank you so much. Like I said, I wish I had you for a third hour, Dan. You're always welcome back if you want to come back in another time and we can talk more about it. And I want to thank everybody for joining me this Monday. I super appreciate all of you guys coming and checking out my show and giving it a listen. I think we cover a lot of great topics. And I just want to let everybody know that right after this, we have the Fenton Perspective. So definitely, check it out. Great show. And on Studio B, we have The Tipping Point with Scott McKay. So definitely check those out. Great host, great stuff they cover. Thank you, Dan, for coming on and breaking this case down with us. Have a great day or great evening, guys, and stay safe.
Thank you.
Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio